information. It's what we do. AM 550 KFYR.
You are listening to Odyssey on Health. Our guest is Dr. Emmanuel Tanney. We are talking about a condition that is known as IHRF, intracranial hypertension. Quite simply put, I believe I can paraphrase this doctor and correct me if I'm wrong. It's a condition where there is just too much spinal fluid.
No, not quite. Okay. It's not too much spinal fluid, but too high a pressure in the spinal fluid that does exist. Actually, spinal fluid is produced by a small vascular network within the brain, and that fluid, it's a clear fluid, travels around the brain. It's kind of a cushion. It provides buoyancy, and that fluid is produced at 0.3 cc's per minute every minute of our lives, and it must exit. Otherwise, we would have an excessive amount of pressure and excessive amount of volume.
How does it exit the body?
It exits through small channels called arachnoid granulations. They're one-way channels. The fluid passes into the venous circulation, blood circulation, around the brain, and it is then carried away. So if anything interrupts this normal neurohydrodynamic flow, that is, if there's obstruction anywhere, for example, at the arachnoid granulations, there's a back pressure, and that's what we call intracranial hypertension. We think, in most cases, that is where the problem exists. We don't think it is a hypersecretion event, but more apt to be an outflow problem.
Now, how long have you been studying this, and in relationship with some of the other research that is being done on particular diseases? It sounds to me like this is almost in an infant's stage.
Well, actually, what's quite interesting, this is a very ancient disease, and actually has been described in humans by Arctic explorers in the 1500s. The explorers had been trapped on ice floes and were required to eat polar bear. Eating polar bear was fine, but when you ate their liver, you got a huge amount of vitamin A, and hypervitaminosis A, or a large amount of vitamin A, produces intracranial pressure. Enough to kill people, enough to blind them, enough to create mental disorders, and fortunately, one of the explorers, I believe he was Dutch, was able to record this and bring it back to Europe, and that was the first description. As far as my involvement goes, I have seen patients over my medical career, but by and large, they were sort of an oddity to me because I didn't have a great deal of information, and physicians are not given a great deal of information because there isn't a great deal of information about it. But the important thing, I think, is to remember that there are lots of diseases that have been around for a long time. This one has fallen through the cracks in terms of research and money spent on bringing about change or developing new drugs. Drug companies particularly have not been involved in developing any new drugs for this.
Why is that? Because it's not flashy enough? Or?
Well, I think the problem hasn't really been well defined, and in order to accomplish that, we put together the foundation and an entity called the Intracranial Hypertension Registry. It's a database of patients who have this disorder. We accumulate information, medical information. It's secure. It's private. We actually run it in conjunction with an organization called the KCI Institute at the Oregon Health and Science University. It's a combined operation between our foundation and the university. It's secure, and it's protected by what we call the Institutional Review Board. It complies with HIPAA. But all of the data that's accumulated begins to give us a new picture. We learn how many people are out there. We begin to learn why they have problems and what the nature of their problems are, and it leads to a research process. And I hope that sometime during the program we'll have an opportunity to offer the phone and the email contact for the registry for those patients who have interest in joining. It is now probably, after 2 years, the largest collection of medical data in the world on these patients.
Dr. Tanney, it appears that there's a lot of people that are suffering from headaches from what you described with your daughter. She went through a period of months before they finally identified the problem with her. Are there a lot of people that have problems with headaches? Are they being ignored by providers, or is it just a very difficult condition to identify? Why is it that it takes so long to identify this?
Well, that's an excellent question. And actually, there are several routes by which these patients are identified. For example, sometimes they may not have any headache at all, but simply have swollen optic nerves. And a chance examination by an ophthalmologist or an eye professional notices the swelling of the optic nerves, papilledema, and immediately becomes concerned that the patient might have a brain tumor. The patient is sent off to a physician, a neurologist, or a physician who will in turn get neuroimaging, or what we call an MRI, and rule out a brain tumor. Then the process reverts back to try to find out what this is, and one comes up ultimately with this diagnosis. Or, on the other hand, the patient may present with a headache that cannot be explained and may not have swollen optic nerves. Those patients take more time to diagnose because they go through their MRI, which is almost always negative, and ultimately, until they receive a spinal tap, the diagnosis often is presumed but not confirmed. So there is an effort to make physicians more aware. Another big problem is that the care is fragmented. So we have neurologists involved. We have neuro-ophthalmologists. We have neurosurgeons. We have pediatricians, because it does occur in children. We have internists. We have family physicians, all seeing these patients, all needing the help of additional specialists to confirm the diagnosis. Very often that occurs.
Do they communicate back and forth, or is that a problem too, do you think?
Well, I think they do communicate. The problem is it's, for example, that if a neurologist makes the diagnosis, he's concerned about the eyes. He then brings an ophthalmologist in to confirm and do visual fields and vision checking and examination of the optic nerves to confirm that part of the picture. And then ultimately, if the patient cannot be managed medically, the patient moves off to a neurosurgeon. And in those cases, then the neurosurgeon, when completed with his work, will refer back to, for example, the ophthalmologist, as the eyes and vision are the main concern, or perhaps back to a neurologist or another individual. So we have a gamut of people involved with really hard to have somebody who is the champion or the leader of the group in many, many circumstances.
Our guest is Emmanuel Tanney, one of the doctors, or a doctor, I should say, who specializes in chronic intracranial hypertension. Dr. Tanney, are there any other diseases that can bring about this particular symptomology that you're talking about? For example, if there's MS or any other things that could cause some of the buildup of this fluid?
Yes, also an excellent question. There are actually two categories of intracranial hypertension. One we call primary or idiopathic. It also goes by an old name called pseudotumor cerebri, which means false brain tumor. Not a very good diagnosis, description for the diagnosis, but the primary group are basically females 20 to 40 years of age, most often overweight. They make up 90% of this primary group. There's a secondary group. That is a group where we can determine a cause. There are probably somewhere 50 to 75 causes for intracranial hypertension in this group. For example, something as simple as sleep apnea, or as complicated as renal failure, or perhaps a drug, as in my daughter's case, medication. One common medication is tetracycline or minocycline. There are many drugs that have been recorded in the literature as causing this. And so if you look at the secondary group, we have a broad spectrum of potential causes. So when someone presents with a headache, for example, a young child, we might want to investigate very intensely that they don't have a blood clot within the venous circulation around the brain, or they don't have an underlying disorder that might have been produced by growth hormone injections or some sort of metabolic disorders or anemia. So there's lots of things like that that can lead to a secondary diagnosis.
AM 550 KFYR, you are listening to Odyssey on Health.